want to thank all of you for being here. I want to start this morning in a little bit different way than sometimes I do, because something happened this week that is a little unusual. I got a letter from my mother-in-law, which I don't get very often. She shared something with me that has nothing to do with anything else we're going to do this morning, but I thought I would still share it with you. It went over better probably in the first hour than it will appear for reasons that will become obvious in just a moment. She said that Jacob was age 92 and that Rebecca was age 89 and they had made the decision to get married. She might have known better than the other hour. Jacob and Rebecca went for a stroll as they were thinking about their wedding, and on the way they passed the drugstore, and Jacob suggested that they go in. And they went in, and Jacob said to the man behind the counter, "Are you the pharmacist?" And the man said, "Yes." And he says, "We're about to get married, but you got heart medication." And the pharmacist said, "Of course we did." And Jacob said, "How about medicine for circulation?" And the pharmacist said, "All kinds. Rheumatism and scoliosis, sure, get back to it. Memory problems, arthritis, jaundice. You have a large variety of work. What about vitamins, sleeping pills, geritol, antidotes for Parkinson's disease?" The pharmacist said, "Absolutely." "Wheelchairs and walkers?" Pharmacist said, "All sizes, all speeds." Jacob said to the pharmacist, "Good. We'd like to use you for our right away." Please turn to 1 John. We've been looking at 1 John, the first couple of chapters. Last week, we came to 1 John chapter 2. There's a couple of verses that we read. Chapter 2, verse 1. "My children, I am writing this to prevent you from sinning, but if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the upright. He is the sacrifice to expiate our sins, and not only ours, but also those of the whole world." And what we saw last week was two words. Advocate, which we did talk about some already, and using a verb form, expiation, which we haven't talked about yet, but which we are going to talk about this week. Now, if you followed along in your version, your translation, you may have seen some other words. Did you? What words did you see other than this one? You saw propitiation, a word which is almost as big. Anybody see anything else? Yeah, there is a translation out there that says atoning sacrifice. And I will point out the word sacrifice is actually in the translation I read to you, sacrifice and expiate for the destruction of the given. Okay, if you were here last week, you have an assignment. If you weren't here last week, you're off the hook. You can just enjoy the sweat of those who did have the assignment. And the assignment was to go and look up in a Bible dictionary sometime the words expiation and or propitiation and try to find it. And then my curiosity was very high. Did any of you do your assignment?
Yes.
Several people did. That's excellent. The other assignment, I'm not going to say why I can't hear. The other assignment was to go and read Numbers chapter 7. Why are we supposed to read Numbers chapter 7?
Not our
answers, don't know. But I did say a couple of things about it, and maybe that's a good place to start. There's a little book in the library. It's there because I put it there because I had been given this little book, and I found it impressive enough that I thought I wanted to share it with some people that I didn't want to get my book away from. the title. And its title is, How to Enjoy the Boring Parts of the Bible. And in this little book, there's a chapter entitled Numbers 7. And early in that chapter, it says, Numbers chapter 7 is the king of the boring parts. The most boring chapter in the Bible. And I was about to tell you that all the people so they could remember. All the people say the same thing. The point of the book is to make you aware that there are no more boring parts in the Bible. And what may appear to be the most boring part of the Bible is actually the most exciting part of the Bible. And so what I want to do this morning is try to make it simple actually. In any event, somebody ran to the library and checked this out so quickly that the rest of you couldn't have a chance at it. Apparently, you don't hear about it. I just want to make one connection with this. Are any of you in the habit of reading your comments? You in the habit of reading the comments to us in the newspaper? Do you read the comments to Paul Potts-Truck? There's a somewhat dysfunctional family representative. Here, there are parents who are sometimes if there was him or two teenagers, a girl and a boy, either who had much interest in anything, certainly not in that academic. And there's a younger brother who is borderline Einstein genius. Athletic ability, a little short, but academic ability is just so far through the roof, it's not funny. And he has a little friend who's about the same level, and they very often end up doing things together. And one of the partnerships this week, it shows that young man, he's pictured as being maybe 10 or something like that, and he has a football. And he said to his friend, the other Brighton, go deep. And the other one looked at him and said, how can free will coexist with divine predestination? That panel just has the two looking at each other. And the third panel, the ethics of it, has the first young man saying to the second, Now, I say that to say there could not have been a more perfect partnership for this particular week. We are going into deep waters. I'm going to try to show you where there's a couple of times to stand on if you feel like there's some mud sucking at your ankles. That's okay. That's going to work out well too. In essence, what Philip Rosenbaum does in this little book is to connect some things up. And one of the things that he's doing is to connect number 7 with the concepts that are hiding in these words. So it's time. Those of you who did your homework on the words expiation and propitiation, what is the time you mean? Can you give us any of a capsule form you're ready with an essay out there? Capsule form.
Expiation, Hebrew family words, is fundamental of the solution for sin, and the most common expiation is the idea of atonement. It has to do with removing the blot of sin.
Okay. Anybody want to add to that before we go off to propitiation, the other thing that's not a word about it?
I had an additional piece of that which says to make amends.
I've got one over here that did some homework. I've got two over here, but you can interestingly talk about when you're talking about number 7.
I
don't
know, right. But then I got some more numbers too.
Okay, well, good. Read any Leviticus?
I have.
Anybody else have anything
going
on? How about propitiation? Are those the same words?
No.
The removal of God's punishment for sin is the perfect sacrifice of Jesus Christ.
That's very articulate.
Yeah, that is right over the chart in Romans in my Bible.
The removal of God's punishment, and you said through.
Yes. God's punishment for sin is the perfect sacrifice of Jesus Christ.
You had anything on propitiation?
Yeah, it actually goes back to the word used by Hayden and then typically saying that after appeasing another person's anger by the offering of a gift,
In the first hour, I couldn't remember whether there's one or two feet in the front end of the pavement. Do you have two on your page?
Yeah.
I put one and I put two on that one. I said, make your choice.
Remember with the sentence that after you that Christ's sacrifice both propitiates or turns away the wrath of God and expiates or covers you.
Okay, smoke it, okay. Propitiates or turns away
the wrath of God and then expiates or covers you. From a positive standpoint, propitiation, as I, you know, one of the definitions says, a favorable disposition, or to cause to be favorable disposition. Now, I sort of like that because there's like the positive piece, you know, there's the a positive one.
To create a favorable disposition in one who was offended might be the implied meaning of that thought. Or create a favorable disposition in the place of one who was offended. Anything else? Okay. Roll up your pants later. We're ready to start. Phil Rosenbaum has given me a lot to think about in this chapter on number 7. And there's a second place that I'm drawing from that I want you to be aware of. You've heard me talk a couple of times, at least I hope you have, about a set of commentaries written by a guy named William Barclay. There are some of his names that talk about the Old Testament, the ones he wrote, I'm told, are focused on the New Testament. And scattered in his commentaries are some very interesting things. But he's written a couple of books where some of those comments are gathered together. This is one of them. It's called The Mind of St. Paul. There's a companion book called The Mind of Jesus. And in this book, and gathering together some things that actually are scattered out across some of his commentaries, but he gathers together in one place what he calls seven great words. Seven great words that Paul uses to talk about salvation. One of those words is justification. And that word connects to images of law courts, things that are happening in law courts, justification. Second is reconciliation, which is connected with friendship, or broken friendship that's restored. A third word is redemption, which comes from pictures of slavery. A fourth word is this word, variously translated expiation or propitiation, which comes from images of the Jewish religious system, especially the sacrificial system. And then the fifth of these six words is adoption, which is coming from images within the family. And then there's a sixth word that doesn't exactly come from anywhere, but sort of binds all the others together, called sanctification. And so some of the comments that I'm going to make this morning are connected to some things that I read in Barclay's book. Now, what I want to tell you is that if you read through what Barclay says, and Barclay says the word that's been translated, at least in Greek order, philisterion. The word is philisterion. And that word occasionally shows up in the New Testament in a quotation from the Old Testament, so it's then connected with that particular Hebrew word. And the word in the New Testament and the word in the Old Testament, the Greek word and the Hebrew word, all of those essentially connect. They don't necessarily mean, but they connect to the same thing. And what they connect to is the mercy seat, which is sometimes called the atonement cover. Now, is that enough to tell a few of you what we're talking about? What's the mercy seat for the atonement cover? Where's that image coming from? Coming from the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was essentially a box. Okay? It was essentially a box, and the box had a cover. And the cover was called the mercy seat of the atonement cover. The word that is translated like this is a word that goes straight back to the text. Cure.
Right.
Sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. So let's carry on. Mercy trees or common place. Now, I want to just let that sit for a moment or two. And while that sits, I want to go to number 7.
Some of you want the number 7, right? They didn't want the number 7.
Didn't like it there very much.
And Wayne said he went there.
I wonder why he ever didn't say the 12 tribes and used the same four verses. But each one, it was taught in the Bible. I kept looking for two goats rather than one, but I couldn't bring it back. That's exactly and precisely the point. Now, let me remind you. The Roman law identifies this as the king of the border part. How many verses in this chapter?
A lot.
A lot is a very good answer. There are very few chapters in the Bible that have this many verses. There is one chapter that I know of that had a word, that's Psalm 119. I can still remember the date. It was about 15 years ago. There were visiting musicians. She was sitting at the piano with a microphone. Her husband was up at the podium with a microphone. And he was introducing the song that they were going to sing. She was going to be singing along with him and sort of due adoration. And he said, this morning, we're going to sing to you a study of the 119th song. And all of the congregation, a small number of people would come. Everybody thought about the implications of that. We might still be there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And she leaned the microphone and said, that's the 19th song, the 19th song. But even in the 119th psalm, it's not particularly boring. What's boring about this? The repetition. The repetition. So what I want to do with you is I want to look for a moment at what's in here. And then let's see what we can do. So, stick with me here a second. Have you found number 7? You can let First John go. I don't know if we're going to be back there. Numbers chapter 7. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Numbers chapter 7 starts out, on the day Moses finished erecting the dwelling, and your translation probably says tabernacle, the tent of meeting is sometimes called in some translations. This is the worship tent. When he finished erecting the dwelling, he anointed and consecrated it and all its furniture, as well as all the altar, as well as the altar and all its equipment. Let's reread that portion, just to make sure we all see it. On the day Moses finished erecting the dwelling, Moses went up on the mountain, God gave him instructions. The instructions were to come back down and put and build some things. Use artisans and craftspeople from the nation and build some things. On the day that he finished erecting the dwelling, he anointed and consecrated two things. What was the first one? My translation said he anointed and consecrated it and all its furniture, as well as, he named the second thing, the altar, the mindset, and all its equipment. Okay so far? What do we have? We've got the dwelling, or the tabernacle, or the tent of meeting, and we have the altar. On the day Moses finished erecting the dwelling, he anointed and consecrated it and all its furniture, as well as the altar and all its equipment. When he had anointed and consecrated it all, the leaders of Israel made an offering. When he had anointed and consecrated it all, I think that it refers to the first of these two. And I'll tell you why I think that in just a minute. The leaders of Israel made an offering. Verse 2, they were the heads of their families, the tribal leaders who had presided over the census. They brought their offering before the Lord. This is verse 3, and there's a colon. What's their offering? You reading that? What's their offering?
Six covered wagons
and 12 oxen. One wagon for every 2 liters and 1 oxen each. How many oxen? How many liters? How many? Why were there 12 liters?
12 oxen.
Okay.
They brought them in front of the dwelling. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, "Accept them from them and let them be set apart for the service of the tent of meeting. You will give them to the Levites, each as his duties require." The next part is not something we need today, but we might need it later, so I'm going to take just a moment. What do you do with those six ladies? There are three groups mentioned. They're all sons, their families or clans within the tribe of Levi. There are the Gershonites. Do you find those in verse 7? The Merarites in verse 8, and the Kohathites in verse 9. There's Levites, Bozites, and the other ites. Alright? What do you do with the six wagons and the 12 oxen? Don't take too long. I don't want to say it, but I want to make sure we say it. He gave a third to the first three. A third of the wagons, six wagons, one third would be two. Very good. 12 oxen, one third would be four. You've done great. And he gave two-thirds to the second group, the Merarites, four wagons and eight oxen. The verse 9 says something really interesting, doesn't it? But the Kohathites, he gave, I said, none at all. Because the sacred charge entrusted to them had to be carried on their shoulders. I'll leave that for another day. Just flag that. Someday I'll come back to that. I've been actually thinking about that for a little while. And someday we'll come back to that. That's verse 9, right? How many verses have we gone through so far? Verse 1 tells us what he's going to do, dedication of the dwelling, or the tent of meeting, and dedication and consecration of the altar. And then verse 2 through verse 9 is the dedication and the consecration and the offering for what? For the tent of meeting. Look at verse 10. What does it say in verse 10? May you then make an offering for what? For the dedication. The offering. From verse 10 through verse 84, and actually through verse 88, but 84 sort of three years. That's all talking about the dedication and the offering for what? For the offering. Now let's just check here for just a minute. We've got eight verses, right? Verses 2 through 9 is talking about the dedication and the offering for the tent of meeting for the tabernacle. And then starting after that, we have approximately 80 verses. That's about 10 times as many, right? And it's offering for the altar. Who does the tabernacle represent? What does the tabernacle represent? God's law. That's the center of worship. It contains the Holy of Holies. Inside the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant. On top of the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat. And they can make verses to dispense with this and build you. Why did they do that for the other part? It only took 8 verses. Why didn't they take 8 verses for the other? The world involves it. There's something important in that difference. Which one gets more space? Well, sir. Which one gets more time? How long did it take for that first offering? How long did it take for that first, the one in verses 2 through 9? How long did that take? Let's look back and see what you think.
How long did it take?
To finish, to complete that offering. No more than a dozen. Maybe as little as 15 minutes. Here comes the 6 wagons, 2 wagons of this one, 4 wagons of this one. You're pretty much done. Maybe you got quiet on things for a couple of minutes. Maybe you got with you down there, a couple of ribbons or something like that. I don't know, but it doesn't sound like it takes very long. Everybody feel okay? How long did the second one take? One full day for each tribe. The first, the church, pretty much time at all, was dedicating the center of worship, the heart of worship, the Holy of Holies, and the tabernacle that was around it, all the worship activities. What was the second one dedicated? What happens on the altar? Which one's the prettier place? If it's in the heart, I'm not asking the right question. The tabernacle is probably gleaming in the sun, lots of gold, lots of burnished wood, lots of brass, right? Tell me about the altar. It might have looked good before it was ever used.
fourth one.
But once it was used, it was ugly and disgusting. Go back to the ministry and pay it into all this. You've got 12 days in here, right? Verse 87, the sum total animals for the burnt offering that's involved in these nearly 80 verses. 12 bulls, 12 rams, 12 male yearling lambs, along with cereal offerings, 12 he-goats, and then it adds it all up. Okay. That's a lot of blood drops. That's disgusting. It's offensive. It's repellent. And they spent 12 days on it. I don't want to know what to get what, but look for a moment at the first day. This is chapter 7, verse 12. Verse 11 says, they brought their offerings before the altar. The Lord said to Moses, each day one of the leaders must bring his offering for the dedication of the altar. Verse 12, the first day. Verse 18 is the second day. Verse 24 is the third day. It keeps going like that. Look at what's wrong on the first day. Look at what's wrong on the second day. Tell me what you see. Except for the name of the leaders in the tribe, it is exactly the same. It's exactly the same. You almost have a picture of them weighing the animals that they were bringing, so that every animal weighed exactly the same. What happens on the altar? Sacrifice. And they're spending 12 days doing it. Why? Let me ask you a question.
Don't bother the bomb. Either hint that or gift, I can't remember, I think McKinney did this one. What is the most important sacrifice that ever took place in the Jewish sacrificial system?
The atonement from the Old Testament.
There is a sacrifice that's more important than that.
I have to know.
More important than that.
Okay.
What is the singular most important? That atonement every year. They did it again. Every year they did it.
What's one sacrifice?
And the whole Old Testament is setting you up for that. Everything that happens in the Jewish sacrificial system is an echo or an earthly image, model of that one perfect sacrifice. Where does that sacrifice take place? On a cross. Where was the cross? Outside the worship. Here's the worship center. Here's the cross outside. Here's the bed that changed. Here's the worship center. Where's the altar? What happens on the altar? Horror happens on the altar.
That's all Russell wants to say.
When was the cross dedicated? When was the cross consecrated? What answer would you give?
Let me give you the answer to the problem. Right here, in number 7. By dedicating the altar, God would have his people dedicate the place, the sacrifice. And it wasn't really the altar, but the ultimate altar.
The real
the cross that was dedicated. Because nowhere else in the Bible is the cross ever dedicated. Nowhere else in the Bible is it consecrated for the past year. So I can get a little less bored. Starting to get a little more excited.
And Rosenbaum said he thinks that is absolutely what was meant for this thing. What is happening here, what is happening here is more important than what's happening here. Or what's happening here has to be connected with what's happening there. I think this is true with this. I'll show you what this means in just a second. If you don't connect what's happening here to what's happening there doesn't mean a thing. Now let me show you how this works. Let me show you how this works. Turn to Leviticus 15. I told you I was going to go back to Leviticus sometime. Did not say that. Stick with me. Leviticus 15. Leviticus 16 describes the Great Day of Atonement, the one that Bill just referred to. which the book of Hebrews describes and says, when Jesus sacrificed this place, he entered a holy of holies that wasn't made with hands. The real one of which the earth was holy of holies was the model. Take a look at chapter 16, Leviticus verse 15. He, that is, the high priest, will then slaughter the goat for the sacrifice for the sin of the people and take its blood inside the curtain, and with this blood do as he did with the blood of the bull. What's that? Sprinkle it on the mercy seat and in front of it. This is how he must perform the rite of expiation. There's that word. That's the Hebrew word. For the sanctuary, for the uncleanliness of the Israelites, for their acts of rebellion, and for all their sin. And this is what he must do. For the tent of the meeting, which remains with them, surrounded by their uncleanness, no one must be inside the tent of the meeting from the moment he enters to make expiation in the sanctuary until the time he comes out. What is supposed to happen with the sacrifices on the altar? You take the blood, where? Inside the holy holes, and sprinkle blood on the mercy seat. So far, okay? Exodus 25. By the time the Leviticus passage is going to be speaking of, that's right. But what we're talking about is the Numbers and Judges. I'm taking you to Exodus chapter 25. Exodus 25 is Moses' instructions, from the end of Moses' instructions about what to do. Building the dwelling and building the altar. Take a look at the last verse of chapter 25 of Exodus. My translation says, and see that you work to the design which was shown you on the mountain. The book of Hebrews says, Moses got blessed of the real Holy of Holies, where Jesus entered with his own blood. Now back up to verse 22. Chapter 25, verse 17, you will also make a mercy seat of pure gold, and it describes how to make it. Verse 21, you will put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and inside the ark you will put ceremonial kind of give you that commandment. Verse 22, there I shall come to meet you from above the mercy seat, from between the two winged creatures which are on the ark of the testimony, I shall give you all my orders for the Israelites. Now, come to the end of number 7. You got enough background now to appreciate what's here at the end of the night. Well, I'm impressed with that. Moses saw that God. That's impressive. That's very impressive. Take a look at the last verse of chapter 7 of Numbers. My translation is says, when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, that is, to speak with God. Now, what do we say to with him into the tent of meeting? What would he take with him into the tent of meeting? He would take the blood of the sacrifice. Sprinkle on the mercy seat. He had now done everything God said to him. He had built all the things God said to build. The dwelling and all the furniture, the altar and all its equipment. All that has been built. On the day that he finished this, they dedicated the dwelling, and then over the next 12 days, they dedicated the altar. That is now finished. All sacrifice has been done. He now takes the blood and goes into the tent of meeting. That's what they did now. And all of a sudden, the verse in Exodus 25, 22 is going to be fulfilled. God says, when you've done all that, that's where I will be.
They didn't take the blood in every day?
I don't think so. I think it came here in verse 89. I can't be positive that fashion, so. Remember, the echo of this that comes in Leviticus. The echo of this in Leviticus is you do this once a year. And one person does it, and that's a big deal when you do it.
Okay? So you tie a rope.
Right.
Remember,
nobody else does it. Without having to go in.
In the first hour, somebody said, when I did the work,
wasn't he sat down with his fire and took a rope down there.
Yes.
That's right. Probably did. I don't know if they would have done it earlier. But by the time they had established the Day of Atonement, that was back when they teased us and all of that
sort
of
thing. Someone had to have died when that time kind of difficult
problem. Yeah. You sort of think, though, well, somebody was sitting there worried about what could happen. What could happen?
In Chapter 7, you say that all of the charges of doing this got sort of worked out of doubt and like completeness.
That's the picture of righteousness.
The one after, so we had to have all of them involved.
After, you get the marching orders. Here's what you're supposed to do. Craftsmen and other kinds of highly skilled workers are to construct all these things so that you can begin to do the things you've been ordered to do. And when that was done, all the work was done, and they began to use those things, then part of what they did at the beginning of the use was a ceremony of dedication and offering. And the offerings are short and brief for the worship center, and they are long and protracted for the altar. And when all of that is finished, the next verse says, Moses went in. And I think if you go back to Exodus 25, 23, he would have taken in the blood, he would have sprinkled it for the first time. And look at the rest of the verse. When Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he heard the voice speaking to him. That's the voice of God. From above the mercy seat on the Ark of the Testimony, from between the two great points of truth. Okay?
Is there a consensus of the fact that the Ark was involved with the presence of Christ?
Is there? I think there's a gigantic significance for that, yes. Which is the point I was about to make.
Okay. You want to read a little bit into the table?
I'm intended to refer you to Hebrews. You found the particular passages there. Yeah, go ahead.
Every half is eight, according to Hebrews. Every half priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, and so it was necessary for this one also to have something to offer. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest, for there are already men who offer the gifts prescribed by the law. They serve in a sanctuary that is a copy and shadow of what is in heaven. This is why Moses was born when he was about to build the tabernacle. See to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain. But the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is mediator is superior to the old one and is founded on better promises.
Does anybody know what words come right after that? The high priest enters once a year, and year after year he has to do it again. Jesus enters once and for all. Once and for all. They enter with the blood of bulls and bricks and goats. He enters with his own blood once and for all.
There is really a difference. Jesus died for my sins. Sacrificing animals under the old covenant is really not a solemn view of sin. It is an admission that you have sinned. Is that true?
I think I'd rather come in the way Hebrews comes in.
Okay.
The sacrificial system is a model of a reality that comes when Jesus comes in. The model is, this is what has to happen. You get an up close look at it. It's awful. It's terrible. It's horrible. The sacrifices have to be made. And what's
left in Hebrews is what
Hebrews said. You know, these were no action. You have to bring in. You have to bring in.
Sure. But that is admitting that you sinned. Has nothing to do with forgiveness. It might be a form of righteousness, and it was the prescription that the Mosaic law gave. But in the truth, there was no true forgiveness. Otherwise, we can make sacrifices today.
No, there's going to have to be on the altar, and the altar destroyed 78 days. There is no atonement for sin today, except in Jesus.
What I'm saying is there wasn't forgiveness of that sin under the old scripture.
Old scripture, on the altar there was.
I don't think the Bible tells you
do that. I think we need to hold off here for just a second. If you read Hebrews, it says it had to be done again and again and again because it did not last. And let me come back here for just a minute. I want you to see something. Expiation talks more about an action. Expiation talks about what was done. Propitiation talks about consequences. What that action accomplished. What Barclay says is, the word that's being used strikes a place that's so much more wonderful than this. It talks about the place where this is done. The place where this is done. And the place where this is done, the clue that you get is in number 7. The place this is done is on the cross. Jesus' sacrificial death has accomplished all that's necessary for us to be brought together. Now, in the first hour, they brought up a word in their background reading on these things that you've not brought up yet. Very important that word come out. And the word is reconciliation. And you'll remember that was another one of those great words that Paul spends time with. But in essence, there is the consequence of who Jesus is and what he did on the cross for you and for me. Makes it possible for the barriers between God and us to be taken away and for us to be reconciled, to have proper and full relationship with him as children, as his children. Jesus becomes the place where that happens. He is our good stereotype, the place where we are reconciled. When Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father except by me, he's saying exactly the same thing. He's saying precisely and exactly the same thing. How are you doing so far? Now let me take you one more step. When God finally talked to Moses in that way, it was a consequence of Moses' obedience. When God talked to Moses that way, it was a consequence of the obedience of the people. They had done what they needed to do. And it was immediately after the people's recognition of the significance of the altar, which Rosenbaum suggests was a stand-in for the cross. I find that thought powerful. And it makes me want to know, when God finally talked to Moses after this was done, what was the first thing he talked about? Don't look yet. Where do you think you're going to find it? We just read the last verse of chapter 7. Where do you think we're going to find the subject that they talked about? Maybe the front end of chapter 8. Would you please read the next couple of verses? What did they talk about? What did they talk about? What was the next subject of the verse? Numbers chapter 8, verse 1, verse 2, verse 3. I don't know how far you have to go. What's the first thing they talked about, Bruce?
The language.
Let's talk about lamps and lampstands. How many?
Seven
golden lampstands. Anybody remember reading about seven golden lampstands anywhere else in the Bible? Revelation chapter 1. Let's go. Would you meet me there, please? Revelation chapter 1. Verse 9, I, John, your brother and partner in hardship in the kingdom and in perseverance of Jesus, was on the island of Patmos on account of the word of God and the witness of Jesus. It was the Lord's day, and I had a vision. I heard a loud voice behind me like the sound of a trumpet saying, write down in the book all that you stood. Verse 12, I turned around to see who was speaking to me, and when I looked, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the middle of them, one like the Son of Man, the words that Paul described. The book of Revelation, as much as anything, was written to answer this question. Where is Jesus now? Jesus has been ascended. The persecution times are coming and they're awful. Where's Jesus now? And the first answer is in the first chapter, and the answer is he's in the middle of the seven lights, golden lampstands. Well, what good does that do me? Well, come over to verse 20, because Jesus starts to talk to John, and he says, the secret of the seven stars you see in my right hand, and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. Angels also means messengers, which could mean pastors or leaders. It could mean angels, as we understand angels, and it could mean pastors and leaders. We don't know for sure which. And the seven lampstands are the seven churches themselves. Pause. The number seven in Revelation almost always means what? Completion. So when he says to the seven churches, what do you think? To all the churches. To the complete collection of churches. And the next two chapters, chapters 2 and 3, are instructions to those seven chapters, at least many people believe so. You read those, and you got letters written to every church at every time. When Moses finally heard from God, from the mercy seat, what did he get? He heard about last chance, and the last chance we realize when we see Revelation. We have a portion of seeing the whole Bible. Talk about that. Now, the last thing I want to do is take you to 2 Corinthians. This is the only place you need to go. You can just go to 2 Corinthians and let everything else go. I don't want you to find a chapter 3. What does Hilasterion mean? The place where atonement is made, my sin is blotted out. It's the place that my sin is removed. The problem of my sin is solved. And it's a place where God's wrath is turned away. That's the negative, or when God becomes favorably disposed. Why? Because we have become properly related to His Son, and reconciliation has taken place. Keep your eye on reconciliation. Chapter 3, verse 4. Such is the confidence we have through Christ and faith in God. Let me write that word down. Such is the confidence we have through Christ and faith in God. It's not that we are so confident we can claim any credit for ourselves. All our confidence comes from God. He has given us the confidence to be ministers of a new covenant. He has given us the confidence to be ministers of a new covenant. A covenant which is not of written letters, but of the Spirit, for the written letters kill, so the Spirit gives life. Verse 12, with a hope like this, we can speak with complete fearlessness. We can speak with complete fearlessness. Verse 1 of chapter 4. I'm sorry, let me go to verse 18, chapter 3, the last verse. And all of us with our unveiled faces, like mirrors reflecting the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the image that we reflect, in brighter glory. This is the working of the Lord who is the Spirit. Such, by God's mercy, is our ministry, and therefore we do not labor. We do not lose heart. Some translations, but... Chapter 4, verse 16. This is why we do not waver. Chapter 5, verse 6. We are always full of confidence then. Verse 7. Guided by faith and not yet by sight. Verse 8. We are full of confidence then. Verse 17 of chapter 5. We're coming to the heart of what I want you to see, and with this we will close. For anyone who is in Christ, there is a new creation. The old order is gone, and a new thing stands there to be seen. It is all God's work. He reconciled us to Himself through Christ, and He gave us the ministry of reconciliation. This is what I mean. God was in Christ reconciling the world to Himself, not holding anyone's faults against them, but entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. We are therefore ambassadors for Christ. It is as though God Himself were urging you through us, and in the name of Christ would appeal to you to be reconciled to God. Jesus is our Hilasterion. His death has opened the door to a relationship with God that makes us His children. We are reconciled to God. And what's the first task God gives us? To be reconciled.
Does that mean I'm the one that makes people right with God?
No.
I just take them to the same place that I was taken. I take them to the cross. And at the foot of the cross, I become spotless. Did you hear the words? We have confidence. We work with fearlessness. We do not lose heart. What did the preacher say to that? He talked about courage. What kind of courage? I didn't like the words, but I think I liked what he was trying to say. What did he say? What was his other
courage?
Violent, bizarre, crazy courage. Why? Because all of a sudden, we quit worrying about the things that ordinary people worry about and don't know anything about God. He allows us to be courage. And the thing he talked about, I think, can fit right here if you want to. That's enough. We run out of time, and then let's have a word of prayer, then, Joe. I probably thank you for the time that you give us, and we pray that you make these words come alive in our hearts as we try to learn how to serve you and how to work for you in this world. Teach us that we are indeed ambassadors, representatives of your kingdom, set in this world that sometimes seems to know so little of it. Teach us how to be the reconcilers to work in this place. This is a great example.